RN is taking a look at some of the history behind the Exxon Valdez oil spill, the history of a lost fight for greater oil tanker safety and better oil spill preparedness. Yesterday, we reported on the state's original vision for state-of-the-art tanker safety technology in the Valdez fleet, and how much of the momentum for that was lost as political pressures mounted for a speedy opening of the Trans-Alaska pipeline. State efforts to make the Prince William Sound tanker traffic the safest in the world have been fought by virtually every authority in marine transportation. International shippers have resisted expensive safety measures, and the Coast Guard's taken the view that American tanker safety standards should be no stricter than those applied to international traffic. The federal courts have struck down Alaska's attempt to use its own laws to improve the Valdez tanker fleet. In this second in a series of stories, Peter Kenyon reports on that abortive effort to enforce a tough state tanker law and how Alaska's entire tanker effort fizzled when that law was struck down.
It was a chilly December day, and George Bauer was not a happy man. The captain of the tanker vessel Alaska Standard had almost fallen into Valdez Harbor coming down the ship's ladder. Of course, the fact that he was being hauled off to jail in handcuffs might have had something to do with both his mood and his balance. The year was 1977, and the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation was performing a routine tanker inspection. Well, not exactly routine, but certainly not out of line with DEC's willingness in those days to back up its regulations with tough enforcement. Chevron had ordered its tanker crews not to submit to DEC inspections, and former Commissioner Ernie Muller recalls that there was no question of backing down.
The captain of the Alaska Standard refused to permit us to board his vessel. And our men in Valdez called up the state troopers and said that we'll arrest him, and if the second mate wants to go the same way, that's fine until we find somebody who will let us on and we'll inspect the vessel. So they arrested him and put him in jail, and then the first mate let us on, I guess.
For many, those were the glory days in Alaska's fight against the shipping industry and federal bureaucracy that seemed to have no interest in investing in state-of-the-art tanker safety technology. Not only was the state carrying a big enforcement stick in Valdez, but lawmakers in Juneau were enjoying national attention for having passed the toughest oil spill legislation in the country.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Bob Edwards.
I'm Jackie Judd. In this half hour, reports on Alaska's tough legislation on oil spills and an Alaskan lobbyist who says the federal government is interfering in his state's affairs.
Commentator James Buck.
This report aired on National Public Radio in April 1978.
Last month, as 100,000 tons of oil spilled from the supertanker Amoco Cadiz was causing inestimable damage to the coast of France, members of the Alaskan state legislature were deciding whether or not to back down on a new law that will help protect the state in a similar disaster. Betsy Brenneman covers the Alaskan legislature for Alaska Public Radio. She has this report.
The 1977 law originally appeared as a bill introduced by Alaska's Governor Jay Hammond at the request of the state's departments of law and environmental conservation.
That tough liability law had the oil industry upset, but not as upset as Senator Chancey Croft's tough tanker bill. With that law, the state was basically applying some of the principles of insurance to the TAPS tanker fleet. Essentially, if shippers wanted to haul North Slope crude out of Valdez, they had to pay risk charges into the state's coastal protection fund. Those tanker owners that invested in safety measures such as lateral thrusters, backup propulsion systems, Loran C, and dual radar systems were considered less of a risk and paid smaller charges. Those without these safety devices paid more. As soon as the Department of Environmental Conservation enacted regulations to implement this law, a group of oil and shipping companies went to court to have it thrown out. Walt Parker, who has a long involvement in the TAPS tanker issue, recalls that the initial ruling seemed to take the wind out of the state's sails very quickly.
That, of course, was a part of it was shot down on federal preemption by Judge Fitzgerald in federal courts in 79, I believe it was, and then the other half was shot down by the Dankworth legislature in 1980. They just took it off the books. Well, that was pretty much the end of the effort in Alaska, and as Brock Adams put it when he was introducing a recent bill in the Congress last spring, he says the tanker issue fell off the edge of the world.
In fact, the political foundation that had supported the state's aggressive environmental stance with the oil industry was quietly but rapidly rotting away. The remains of the tanker bill were repealed at about the same time the legislature did the oil industry another big favor by abandoning its method of calculating corporate income tax. Dropping the so-called separate accounting method, which was later upheld to be constitutional, is estimated to have cost the state hundreds of millions of dollars in oil revenue. There were actually two different court challenges to the Alaska tanker laws, and Chancey Croft says the state didn't even bother to appeal one of them.
The only portion of the statute which had been declared unconstitutional and which was appealed, the circuit court reversed and held that it was constitutional. And of course, we don't know what might have happened if there had been an appeal on the rest of it.
Legal analysts believe that some of those tanker provisions would have been found unconstitutional no matter how far they were appealed. But some critics find the state's half-hearted appeals less troublesome than the fact that it let the issue die without trying to find another way to protect its waters. Attorney David Rowe with the Environmental Defense Fund was among those who early on pointed out the dangers of the Valdez tanker situation.
That case makes a good excuse to hide behind if you don't want to act, but it is simply not true that people's hands were tied, that it was illegal to provide for the safety of Prince William Sound.
Walt Parker agrees, pointing out that there was apparently never even an attempt to make sure that the standards that did exist at the time were enforced.
You must always remember that if Exxon Valdez had just done something as simple as stay in the tanker lanes that were established, this would not have happened.
Parker is now chair of a state commission looking into the oil spill, and he's still at a loss to name a reason for the state's declining interest in the safe shipment of North Slope oil.
No real reasons other than, they didn't care.
The next report in this series will look at what critics call Alaska's slide into complacency regarding oil spills, as evidenced by the troubled history of the State Department of Environmental Conservation. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Peter Kenyon.
APRN's been looking at some of the history of the state's attempts to regulate the safety of the system designed to get North Slope crude to market. Over the past 2 days, reporter Peter Kenyon's examined the failure of state efforts to impose state-of-the-art safety technology on the tankers moving the crude from Valdez to ports on the West Coast and through the Panama Canal. Today, we turn to the pipeline that carries the oil across Alaska. Ever since the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was completed 12 years ago, the responsibility for ensuring that Alaska's oil boom didn't bust the environment has rested with one small agency. In this third report, Peter Kenyon looks at the Department of Environmental Conservation and how the state's commitment to protecting the land, air, and water in the path of oil development deteriorated as the oil revenue rolled in.
In January 1983, the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company received the following letter from the Department of Environmental Conservation. DEC is pleased to grant full approval to the Alyeska Valdez Terminal and Prince William Sound contingency plans. The response scenario presented in your letter of June 1982 demonstrates on paper Alyeska's ability to respond to and clean up a major discharge. Compare that with this internal memo from the Valdez office in 1976, commenting on Alyeska's initial contingency plan. The Alyeska plan in almost every major facet contains mistakes and inadequacies, demonstrates microscopic thinking, and worse, omits major functions that are necessary. The initial plan is so bad, the department should consider prosecution for violation of solid waste regulations, and anyone who reviews this plan should get hour-for-hour comp time as sick leave. Was the only difference between 1976 and 1983 an improvement in Alyeska's planning? Industry and state officials agree that the plan did get better, but was it really that much better? Was it transformed from a pile of solid waste to the assurances that the state needed, that Alyeska had in fact been thinking about the unthinkable and was prepared to deal with it? DEC records spanning the past 18 years and interviews with officials who go back to DEC's creation in 1971 suggest otherwise. The evidence paints a picture of an aggressive environmental watchdog born at the beginning of the major environmental battle of the early 1970s, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. It also shows that watchdog later on completely outstripped by the industry it was trying to regulate. This was due in part to a changing attitude toward DEC by policymakers in Juneau. That change revealed itself in the form of draconian funding cuts to DEC that were deliberately applied at the same time the agency was given entire new fields of environmental regulation to carry. The combined effect was devastating, and those moves were made by both Republican and Democratic administrations, along with legislators of both parties. The early days of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation were heady ones for environmentalists. DEC's addition to the cabinet was signed into law in May 1971 by Governor Bill Egan. The Federal Environmental Protection Agency had been created a year before, the year of the first Earth Day, and the environment was enjoying one of its high-profile periods in the cycle of public attention. For the first commissioner, Egan picked a Canadian geologist with 21 years of experience in the Arctic. Max Brewer had directed the Naval Arctic Research Lab in Barrow, and to some he seemed like an odd choice. He once rebuked an environmentalist for calling him their man in the cabinet. But as Brewer settled into his job, developers who had been virtually unregulated before soon felt the sting of the new agency. In fact, for all his suspicion of what he calls preservationists, the plain-spoken Brewer is now seen as the toughest leader DEC's ever had. His clashes with some of his colleagues in the cabinet made headlines. He levied the largest single pollution fine in the United States at the time, $429,000 against a firm on the Kenai Peninsula. But while Brewer wasn't afraid of a fight, he knew even before he took office that the biggest single construction project in the country, the pipeline, was inevitable.
Well, it was quite obvious that something like that would go just because of the magnitude of it.
Brewer was succeeded by Ernie Mahler, who had the longest tenure of any commissioner, all 8 years of the Hammond administration. Some of those who knew him say he managed that by keeping a low profile, in sharp contrast to Max Brewer. A former EPA worker born in Fairbanks, Mahler witnessed both the pre- and post-pipeline versions of DEC. During construction and startup, DEC workers in the field were shocked by the oil industry's refusal to deliver on the promises they had made in order to get Congress to approve the pipeline. A series of 1977 memos from DEC's Prince William Sound supervisor Randy Bayless detailed the problems. Alyeska refused to station protective booms and barges out in Prince William Sound, though both state and the Coast Guard were strongly recommending such a move. And Alyeska was prepared to have on hand less than one-fifth the amount of booms state and federal officials asked for. And to Alaska's dismay, no one seemed to have the authority to force Alyeska to plan for a major spill outside the terminal area itself. In May 1977, with startup looming, Bayless wrote, "With the competent pipeline and advisory monitoring staffs now abandoning ships, things look bleak. If I could find someone who looked like Tano, I'd feel like the Lone Ranger." State Pipeline Coordinator Chuck Champion said at the time that he always had the hammer to stop the project, but he knew he'd be taken out and shot if he ever used it. In fact, while Champion, a former oil company worker, made many comments about the environmental problems with the pipeline, his actions spoke louder. When it came time to stand behind the officials in Valdez who were warning that the project was not ready to be operated safely, the state of Alaska actually granted final approval for the startup before the federal government. The warnings and pleas for help continued to stream out of the Valdez office over the years. Alyeska's contingency plans provided inadequate personnel, equipment, and training, especially for a spill in Prince William Sound. They failed to adequately address dispersants, burning of oily waste, and other key issues still in dispute today. Federal resource officials complained that the spill plans were totally unacceptable. Once again, they wrote, Alyeska has maneuvered the government into accepting a shoddy piece of work. Then, faced with a fully operational pipeline and a host of complaints from its environmental watchdog, the state began the systematic withdrawal of money and staff time devoted to the terminal and marine pollution problem. In 1979, the state pipeline coordinator's office funding was cut in half. The tanker and oil terminal safety program was cut by 75%. DEC's Prince William Sound regional office, faced with the loss of all the other agency help they'd been getting during pipeline construction, asked for an additional position and an extra $30,000. It got reduced instead. Not long after, DEC downgraded the Prince William Sound office and rolled it into the South Central region as a district office, where it remains today. For Max Brewer, who said he had fought like the devil to establish Prince William Sound on the same level of importance as the other regional offices, this was a disappointment. Randy Bayless still says he can't explain it, even though he was in the midst of it.
The state agencies, DNR, Fish and Game, the rest of them were increasing their budgets and swelling, and DEC was not.
Perhaps the weakest period for DEC came in the early 1980s, when enforcement actions plummeted and the agency came to be viewed as little more than a minor annoyance to developers who had close friends in high places. Bayless recalls that the change was noticeable in the field offices.
But at one point, we would have the commissioner of DEC saying, we've got to balance the economic interests against the environmental interests. And I know that the Commissioner of Commerce and Economic Development wasn't sitting over there balancing the environmental interests against his economic interests. At a certain point, that economic consideration entered into DEC's thinking, and that also was coincident with a tremendous decrease in enforcement activity.
Millionaire Democratic Governor Bill Sheffield's first DEC commissioner was Dick Nevay, the only former commissioner who could not be reached for this story. A biochemist by training, the former university professor and Seward politician, is considered the most pro-development commissioner in DEC's history. In a memo to the department, Nevay outlined the goals of the administration. One of those, he wrote, was to achieve an economic environment in which the private sector has prime responsibility for development activity. In some years, the financial squeeze on the agency was disguised by the fact that DEC's total dollar amount began to rise somewhat. But the fact was that the agency's new duties were rising at a much faster rate. By the time Bill Ross took over in 1985, the environmental fires were everywhere. The Point McKenzie burn, long-standing Kenai pollution problems, water quality and placer mining. And he was under orders to cut the budget.
My recollection is that I cut the budget 7 times. When I was in the agency, and culminated with, by the end of 1986, that it was on a 4-day work week in an attempt to prevent the necessity to lay off 20 to 25% of the people.
Meanwhile, the Valdez office was still putting out red alerts on the Alyeska terminal. A few months before Ross was appointed, Valdez supervisor Dan Lawn wrote of a general disemboweling of the Alyeska operational plan. Lawn warned that morale was at an all-time low, knowledgeable staff had quit, and it looked like Alyeska knew the state of Alaska wasn't going to do much about it. Unfortunately, Lawn wrote, DEC's chronic understaffing has been a signal to Alyeska that the state is no longer interested in the TAPS project. We can no longer ignore the routine monitoring of Alyeska unless we do not care if a major catastrophic event occurs. Oil spill drills at the Valdez terminal produced similar results. Acting Supervisor Tom McCarty wrote after a drill in November 1984 that Alyeska's spill response activities have regressed to a dangerous level. DEC subsequently began a lengthy dialogue with Alyeska over its spill plan. While the plan itself began to look better, enforcement and testing by DEC to ensure that the pipeline company could actually do in the water what the plan called for on paper remained spotty. Some of the details of the plan regarding when and where to use dispersants were finalized on March 20, 1989, 4 days before the Exxon Valdez ran aground. When pressed for an explanation of DEC's approach to Alyeska, the officials interviewed for this story came up with a variety of theories. Max Brewer said simply, "There's a lot of glass houses in the countryside." Ernie Mahler and Bill Ross agreed that DEC was never really equipped to deal with all its responsibilities. Former Supervisor Randy Bayless believes that the political drive to support a tough environmental watchdog evaporated as the oil revenue started flowing.
The DEC was created as an enforcement agency primarily. It was to show that the state was capable of building a pipeline without any outside interference. So in the initial days, the agency took a very aggressive enforcement stance, search warrants, midnight searches of corporate offices, arrest warrants, criminal prosecutions. Then, with plenty of oil money in our pockets, we tended to be fat and lazy, and the enforcement posture of the agency was transformed into more of a how to dole out construction grant money for municipalities to build water and sewer, and change its personality from an enforcement agency to a technical assistance agency.
Most of these officials did not feel comfortable addressing some of the legal implications of these issues. For instance, the state is charging Exxon and Alyeska now with a variety of negligent acts, including poor planning, cutting funding for oil spill response, inadequate training and personnel for the situation. Judging by some of the court documents filed on its behalf, the oil industry now appears ready to claim that the state of Alaska is also guilty of those very same things. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Peter Kenyon.
This week, APRN's been examining some of the issues that led up to the nation's worst oil spill. In this final report in his series, Peter Kenyon offers a sampling of what some key officials feel are the lessons to be learned from the Exxon Valdez.
In its broadest terms, the story of the Exxon Valdez spill contains few surprises. In fact, it's as old as environmental activism itself.
I'm afraid that the saddest words in environmental advocacy are, "I told you so." The people who need to learn from this are the people who thought that they could ignore obvious evidence, whoever's job it was to make the safety decision, knuckling under to the momentum of this big project.
Environmental Defense Fund attorney David Rowe. The question of what exactly to do to prevent another Exxon Valdez may never be settled, but some of the people who lost the fight to prevent this spill have been thinking about how to stop the next one. For DEC's first commissioner, Max Brewer, the agency has two big handicaps. It's trying to do too much, and it gave up its in-house research arm.
My feeling was to run lean and specialize in the environment. I have been disappointed that DEC has not personally continued a research program. So that you know what the problem is, that you're not a captive of what is fed to you.
Former Commissioner Bill Ross arrived on the scene after that research program was cut to save money, and he concedes that it hurt, especially during the long-running and sometimes combative investigations of the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company.
Many times over the course of the Alyeska situation, I was frustrated that we didn't have the testing resources, that we didn't have the lab turnaround time, that we didn't have certain kinds of expertise available to us.
More enforcement of the shipping standards that do exist are a priority for Walt Parker. Parker worked for the Pipeline Coordinator's Office, specializing in tanker safety. He cites one example that he hopes won't be ignored simply because it's so obvious.
The tanker lanes were set up for a very good reason. They were our redundancy, you know, failing that we just, since we didn't have the redundancy in safety that we wanted in hulls and in manning systems, why we built it into the tanker lanes.
Parker now heads a state commission looking into the Exxon Valdez spill. For Chancey Croft, the author of Alaska's tough tanker safety law that was struck down by the federal courts, the basic responsibility for cleaning up a spill has never been faced head-on by government.
Nobody would leave up to the building owner the responsibility for handling a fire, much less leave up to the person that actually caused the fire. But that's what we do for some strange reason with oil spills.
Former Commissioner Ernie Muller has several suggestions. First of all, the state and its congressional delegation have to resume pressure on the federal government to improve tanker safety. An effort in the U.S. Senate again this year to mandate double hulls failed by 3 votes. That bill is now before the House of Representatives. Muller says permanent tug escorts will help in some situations. A commitment by the state and the oil industry to a major research effort on global oil spill cleanup technology is needed, he feels, and a computer model showing the structure of the tankers that come into Valdez should be on hand. A tougher regimen of exercises and dry runs for cleanup crews and equipment is an essential link between a cleanup plan that looks good on paper and one that works in the water, says Muller. And perhaps most importantly for the state, he believes Alaska must bring back some of the expertise it's lost, the people who understand tanker safety issues and can keep up with the latest technology. Muller says the pipeline may have already moved the majority of the recoverable reserves in Prudhoe Bay, but the danger of another spill is still very much with us.
People talk about, well, the pipeline is going to wind down and the flow through is going to taper off and all this and that stuff. But the oil industry is going to be in Alaska as long as there is really an oil industry in the United States. And I think we have to be on top of the situation and have people there that are knowledgeable about the marine architecture and navigation safety and the design of vessels and vessel traffic systems. And I don't think the state's doing that right now. I mean, the people that were there are pretty much gone. You know, are we really going to go through this whole exercise again and 10 years from now find out that Horatio's back at the gate with a bucket and a mop and that we haven't learned from the Exxon Valdez situation in terms of having people there who on board who really know the business.
For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Peter Kenyon.
The contamination was found primarily in mussels from Windy Bay, Kodiak Village, and Chenega Bay. While the pink salmon contamination read at most 13 parts per billion, the mussels showed readings in the hundreds at Chenega Bay and the thousands in Windy Bay, an area used for subsistence gathering by the people of both Port Graham and English Bay on the outer coast of the Kenai Peninsula. There was also a slight contamination found in clams and in chitons, called bidarki in local speech. The federal lab also ran a chemical profile of the contamination found in the Windy Bay mussels. It shows almost the exact same pattern of spikes and valleys as that of Prudhoe Bay crude oil. The fish and shellfish samples were all taken by an Exxon contractor near village subsistence gathering areas, with the exception of the slight contamination of the two pink salmon from Larson Bay and even slighter contamination of a pink salmon from waters off Tetitlik. Dozens of fish samples showed none at all. For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Steve Heimel.
Winter plans are still in formulation stages, but time is getting short. So to help the plans along, this past weekend, DEC hosted a teleconference of Native leaders from eight villages from Prince William Sound in the Gulf of Alaska. Rose Dreyer, a Native herself, is DEC's village liaison.
We had mayors and village council presidents from the city of Yuzinki, Port Lyons, and Old Harbor, and Larson Bay, and Karluk over in the Kodiak area. The chairman of the Port Graham Village Council was also with us, as were members of the Chenega Corporation.
Tetitlik was not able to be included in the teleconference because Tetitlik's power generator had been down for 2 days and none of their phones were working. Dreyer says DEC went to the native peoples of the area to ask for their advice.
We feel that the winter wisdom of the indigenous peoples of Prince William Sound and of the Gulf of Alaska are the ones who could have the most practical and the most safety-oriented winter program. And instead of going to the villages and telling them what we want to do to help treat the shorelines this winter, we have asked them what they feel would be practical and safe for the winter.
DEC has urged for many months that winter plans should include a permanent strike force in the area. And Dreyer says that's the other reason for seeking advice from local natives.
They love their shorelands. They rely upon it for subsistence living, and they want to keep all tar balls and all oil debris off the land that they love. They're worried about being able to go fishing next year. They're afraid that the winter storms are going to kick up, especially down in Kodiak. They're worried that a lot of oil is going to be coming down into the Kodiak area, and it's going to ruin their fishing next summer. There's very serious concern, and they want to launch a winter program in order to be able to keep as much shoreline treated as possible.
But Exxon is currently negotiating winter contracts with the natives, and Exxon's operations manager, Bill Rainey, essentially told DEC that the state agency is butting in where it doesn't belong.
Yeah, you may not be aware, but we're currently under contractual negotiations with the village residents on the subjects that you discuss. We, of course, don't plan to comment on negotiations that are underway, nor do we invite third-party intervention.
But the state needs to know what Exxon's plans are in order to determine if the plans are adequate or if the state needs to provide something more. DEC Commissioner Dennis Kelso questioned Rainey about specifics, but to no avail.
What size crew do you envision there?
I don't plan to discuss contractual negotiations that are underway.
Would you expect to have vessels there as well?
I don't plan to discuss contractual negotiations that are underway.
So you don't want to give us a picture of what you have in mind there?
No, I just don't plan to discuss contractual negotiations that are underway.
Exxon's Rainey says DEC will be informed when the contracts are set. Questioned as to how long negotiations have been ongoing, Rainey would only say, not long enough to conclude them. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
Wednesday, a group of village leaders gathered to coordinate their winter plans. The villages have rejected Exxon's proposal to fund a monitoring program this fall. According to Larson Bay's Mayor Charles Christensen, the villagers feel they need to do more than monitor.
Everybody says there's no more oil, but every time the tide or wind changes, there's new fresh oil coming in. So all of a sudden, they want to quit. We don't feel that way in our area. I think we're going to try and continue with some kind of a program this winter. We are all fishermen, and our area down there. Women and children and all go fishing. That's our livelihood. Now, if this isn't continuing for the winter and we're afraid that we're not going to be able to fish again next year, nobody's going to be able to help us. If Exxon don't come in, where will the money come from? We're going to be stuck.
Exxon proposed giving $20,000 to each village plus $50,000 in discretionary funds to be used as the villages saw fit. Larson Bay Tribal Council President Frank Carlson says that amount of money is insufficient. $20,000, he says, wouldn't even cover liability costs. Under Exxon's proposal, villagers would monitor 4 miles of beach and periodically make reports to Exxon. The plan included providing a so-called strike force team for oil cleanup, but the strike force team includes only 2 vessels to cover the entire spill area. Exxon, in turn, rejected a proposal put forth by Larson Bay in which the village asked for a winter cleanup crew to be made up of 10 beach workers and 3 vessels, a garbage boat, a transport boat, and 1 vessel to pick up dead wildlife. At this point, negotiations between Exxon and the villages seems to be at a standstill. Village leaders are working with local and state government officials to develop a winter plan, and says Old Harbor's mayor, Sven Hawkinson, they hope to convince Exxon to pay for it.
Main concern with our fishermen in Old Harbor is the continue of the cleanup so we can get on with our lives and fish next summer. We're totally afraid that this stuff buried will wash out again with zero tolerance on the seines. Well, I don't think Exxon's going to pay another season. I think if they use common sense and good judgment, they could see if they keep a cleanup effort going this winter, they might stay away from having to pay the fishermen next year.
In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
We are all fishermen in our area down there. Women and children and all go fishing. That's our livelihood. Now, if this isn't continuing for the winter and we're afraid that we're not going to be able to fish again next year, nobody's going to be able to help us. If Exxon don't come in, where will the money come from? We're going to be stuck. I don't think Exxon's going to pay another season. I think if they use common sense and good judgment, they could see if they keep a cleanup effort going this winter, they might stay away from having to pay the fishermen next year.
What would happen if Exxon laid off all the cleanup crews and then the Coast Guard said more work needs to be done? Exxon's John Peavy has an answer.
Well, what we hope to do is we hope that situation doesn't arise.
You don't have an eventuality if there's a negative.
Well, right now we don't anticipate that there's going to be that situation that exists. We think we're going to be able to cover it in the time we have left.
But the Department of Environmental Conservation has already blasted Exxon for failing in its efforts this summer. DEC's on-scene coordinator in Valdez, Steve Provant, sent a letter to the Coast Guard saying there's no way Exxon can adequately treat all affected areas by September 15th. But though DEC may protest, beaches can be demobilized with or without the agency's approval. I spoke with Provant about how the beach sign-off procedure works.
Okay, the Coast Guard and DEC both sign off on the beaches. Now, if DEC doesn't agree with the Coast Guard, there's a block for both agencies or both organizations to sign, and if DEC does not agree with the Coast Guard decision, then we can say that we do not approve or agree with that decision. That does not mean necessarily that it will hold up the demobilization of the crew from that beach segment. We try and resolve those before the crews would be moved on, but there are instances where we have not agreed and the crews have moved on to other beach segments.
So they can refuse to sign off if they believe that they don't feel right signing off on a beach?
Well, I guess I would recommend that they sign off, but that they voice their concern as to why, you know, because they can sign it off as not being approved for demobilization. You know, they don't have to, the sign-off does not mean that we're agreeing. We can sign it, but our signing of it can be in disagreement with the decision to allow them to demobilize off that. If we don't sign it, that won't keep them from moving off. If we do sign it and disagree, that won't necessarily prevent them from moving off the beach either. But then we are on record as not agreeing with the cleanup that that beach segment has received.
And what's the purpose of that? I mean, does the state really have any voice then? It sounds like the feds and Exxon are, have all the choice and power here. It doesn't matter what the state feels about whether a beach should be signed off or demobilized. So is that true? That
well, the federal government is, the federal on-scene coordinator is the, has the, is in charge of the oil spill. And it's, he basically is the person that can ask Exxon or in some cases order Exxon to do things. The state just serves an advisory role to the federal on-scene coordinator. So if we're in disagreement with something, it's the federal government can overrule us and go on. And in that case, all we can do is document that we feel the cleanup is inadequate. And, you know, that will come to play later on in any litigation or however this works out in the future. But again, we really are in an advisory capacity here to the federal government.
That's DEC's on-scene coordinator, Steve Provant. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Well, I see us being left alone. Throughout this process, the mayors have had to deal with the problems locally with the complications of the spill. And now as Exxon leaves and curtails the programs and curtails the funds available to us, just because the cleanup activities are done doesn't mean the effects of the cleanup and the spill are gone. There's still going to be extra people in our towns. There's still going to be the piles of garbage in our landfill when they leave. And some of the mayors are real concerned that the state hasn't demonstrated an effective program to be able to take up the slack.
The policy used by state regulators for commercial fishing in spill areas has been zero tolerance. If there's oil in the area, no commercial fishing is allowed. But the beach is a dinner table for coastal Alaska natives, and they've been told to use a smell test to stay away from any seafood that has an oily smell. A couple of weeks ago, the first laboratory test results verified that the nose is a reliable indicator. Now the results from a larger sampling are back from a federal lab. And while they too bear out the reliability of the nose test, they also show substantial contamination of some beach and tidal zone shellfish in areas traditionally used for gathering by natives. Mussels in one area used by two villages showed 3,300 parts per billion of hydrocarbon contaminants. Significant amounts were found in mussels from two other traditional shoreline gathering areas. The testing also revealed lower levels of hydrocarbon contamination in two pink salmon taken from waters where natives traditionally place their nets. In Anchorage, Alaska, I'm Steve Heimel.
After 2 days of storms and a dead whale on the beach, Corexit was finally tested on August 28th and 29th. DEC said a plume escaped. Exxon said it did not. Weather halted any further testing until September 3rd, and again, the same reports were made. DEC's on-scene coordinator, Steve Provant, says DEC does not agree that there was a good oil recovery and says, once again, a plume escaped.
We saw a pretty significant plume leaving the primary boom area. Also, along the shoreline, it was also getting outside the secondary boom. So, again, we observed that it really wasn't effective and they were having a hard time containing it.
Exxon's operations manager, Bill Rainey, disagreed and asked for still another opinion.
I was there, oversaw it from the air. I didn't see what you just described. Admiral Robbins, you were there.
I looked at it at about 2:30, and the plume was well defined. It was inside the primary boom. Apparently, the currents were not taking it along the beach. It was very well defined, as I've said. Later, the Scott commander, my person on scene, looked at it, and the wind effect and the current had taken some toll on it and had moved some of it outside of the secondary boom along the shore.
The plume, that either is or isn't, is a discoloration that appears in the water. Federal on-scene coordinator Admiral Robbins says he believes the plume to be beneath the surface, but he's not sure what causes it or what's in it, so he's asked for more water samples to be taken from the plume on the next test. Test 4 was supposed to have occurred yesterday, but Exxon shut it down after an hour and a half due to waves causing the escape of oil from the primary boom. Late last night, DEC delivered a letter to the federal on-scene coordinator recommending that further testing be halted. Deputy FOSC Captain David Zawadzki says there's also a letter from EPA. Zawadzki says the admiral knows of the recommendations, but so far no decision has been made. According to Zawadzki, it's important to obtain samples of the plume in order to determine just what it is. He says testing was supposed to have occurred today, but he won't know the results until the operations briefing later this evening. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
During the hearing, the message was clear. We don't want the incinerator in Vicota Bay. We don't want it anywhere near Kodiak Island. The borough solicited public comments on not only Vicota Bay, but six other locations suggested by the DEC. Alternatives include Muscomee, Molina, Danger, and Discover Bays on Fog Neck Island, plus Terror Bay and Euganic Passage on Kodiak Island. Jim Carmichael of the Fog Neck Native Corporation said his organization would entertain the possibility of locating the incinerator near Fog Neck Island.
Our preference would be either Danger or Discover Bay, and I understand that Danger Bay would probably be most onerous to Zinke. But either one of those two would have been considered by us.
The corporation's position is one of those two would be an acceptable location, but none of the others.
That's correct.
But Carmichael was the only exception. Ralph Cohn, Port Lyon City Council member, objected to the materials released by the incinerator so close to the city and watershed. He also questioned the character of those from Exxon, AET, and the DEC, who all said the emissions would not pose a threat.
Remember the character of the people who have made all these claims. Our watershed, fish, wildlife. Us humans, it's okay for us to have a few birth defects and a little bit of cancer, no problem. Exxon says it's a low risk. It's very low risk. We don't need Exxon, and we will not allow Exxon to tell us that we're going to undertake a low risk. We don't want cancer. We don't want birth defects. We don't want it in Vicota. We don't want it in Euganic Passage. We don't want it in Terror Bay or any of these other bays, because we don't trust the character of the people that are operating this. We don't trust that machinery, and we don't want those outputs in any of our communities or in Kodiak Island anywhere.
Others from Port Lyons and Kodiak also asked the incinerator be removed, but representatives from other villages spoke up as well. Old Harbor, Yuzinki, Larson Bay, Akiak all said, get it off the island. The borough will consider the comments and then decide if the incinerator is compatible with land, water, and subsistence uses in all seven areas. After that, the borough will submit their response, which the DEC is expecting by Monday, September 11th. But whether the permit is reissued is totally up to the DEC. If necessary, the borough can still appeal to the commissioner after any unfavorable decision, and that could take additional time. Exxon previously stated it planned to pull out the incinerator on September 15th. Even if the permit is reissued and Exxon decides to stay and operate the incinerator in Vicota Bay, it can do so only until September 30th, the date the burn permit expires for good. In Kodiak, I'm Matt Miller.
Part of the mayor's problem was illustrated today by the fact that only about a half dozen of them were able to make it to this meeting in Anchorage. Most of the rest were kept away, either by bad weather or pressing problems at home. This was to be the oiled mayor's big chance to talk with the heads of state administration. Virtually the entire cabinet was there, led by Lieutenant Governor Steve McAlpine and the governor's chief of staff, Gary Peska. Kodiak Mayor Bob Brody is the chair of the oiled mayors, and he expressed their fear and frustration as the Exxon presence winds down.
Well, I see us being left alone. Throughout this process, the mayors have had to deal with the problems locally with the complications of the spill. And now as Exxon leaves and curtails the programs and curtails the funds available to us, Just because the cleanup activities are done doesn't mean the effects of the cleanup and the spill are gone. There's still going to be extra people in our towns. There's still going to be the piles of garbage in our landfill when they leave. And some of the mayors are real concerned that the state hasn't demonstrated an effective program to be able to take up the slack.
The governor's top commissioners argued that many programs are either in place or in the offing, like the winter survey work being planned by the Department of Environmental Conservation. Community and Regional Affairs Commissioner David Hoffman announced that there'll be some relief on the way when his grant review team announces who'll get grants from the $1 million oil spill impact fund set up by the legislature. He acknowledged, though, that the team will have to sift through more than $10 million in grant requests from the beleaguered towns. The mayors will take their case to the legislature at a meeting with state lawmakers set for September 21st. For APRN in Anchorage, this is Corey Flintoff.
In the past, some of the carcasses looked like they had been anywhere from a few days to many months old. But what has concerned us is that some of these are coming in larger numbers. But the necropsies that were done a week or so ago have indicated that some of those may have died from oil-related causes.
We don't want cancer. We don't want birth defects. We don't want it in Vicoda. We don't want it in Uganic Passage. We don't want it in Terror Bay or any of these other bays, because we don't trust the character of the people that are operating this. We don't trust that machinery, and we don't want those outputs in any of our communities or in Kodiak Island anywhere.
As of this week, the cumulative grand total of all the dead birds that we have received and have in our possession is 34,044. We have a grand total of 993 dead otters and 147 dead bald eagles.
Essentially, it looks huge, as everybody knows, but you don't grasp it till you stand out on the same level with her keel. Basically, the thing's about the height of a 12-story building. Some of the larger tanks are about the size of a 10 or 12-story building cubed. It's just overwhelming in its size. And equally overwhelming in its size are the areas at the bottom of the vessel that just aren't there. There were many square yards of plate that are just totally missing right now. And some of the big girders longitudinal members, which are about 3 feet in height with 10 or 12 inch I-beam construction, are broken, twisted like corkscrews. There are large boulders, as the press reported before, the size of Volkswagens, which is pretty close, jammed up into her, which are going to have to be cut out.
Were you able to get a preliminary idea, just based on what you were able to see during this four-day investigation, of in your own mind at least, whether double hull construction would have made a significant difference?
Yeah, now, of course, I'm not a marine architect, a surveyor, or any sort of engineer, so what I think might or might not turn out to be true, but I'm told that the rule of thumb for designing double bottoms is to make the double bottom about as high as 1/15th of the beam of the vessel. In this instance, 166-foot beam, you'd have about 11-foot double bottom built in there. And we saw very few places where the hull had been broached more than 5 or 6 feet. So just judging from that, a double bottom might have well made a significant difference. However, to build a double bottom, they've got to put all sorts of cross members and floors and things like that in there, which could well have been pushed up through the higher bottom in this instance. So I really don't know, but there weren't holes that, or were very few holes that went up as high as 11 feet, which is a theoretical depth of a double bottom.
Kodiak Fish and Wildlife Representative Paul Burke says the agency is now putting together the fine points of a contingency plan.
It is not as easy for government agencies to go out and secure contracts for work vessels and the like as it is for a private corporation like Exxon. This is going to take us several days, but we're working on it, and we hope to have a plan we can release within, I'd say a week.
While the local office is putting together a plan, it's the regional office that's responsible for securing funding for the project. It's still a question whether the money will be made available. If not, the Kodiak Island Borough has included bird catcher boats in its planned winter cleanup program, but the borough, too, is counting on state funding to implement that program. Burke says it remains to be seen whether Fish and Wildlife can resume the bird pickup, but he's heartened by the outpouring of support from the community.
Right now, from Kodiak, we've received several calls from people offering to work on a volunteer basis, and we have been notified by several of the vessel owners and vessel crews that they'd be willing to work on a volunteer basis to get to the bottom of this. These are genuine and generous offers, and they're deeply appreciated. We'll just ask everybody to stand by until we can release a winter contingency plan.
Paul Burke of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Under the Federal Clean Water Act, a damage assessment plan must be put together after any oil or toxic chemical spill. The process by which the damage is assessed is decided by the individual agencies involved. In this case, it's the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and their job is to quantify the harm done to sea otters by the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Nancy Hillstrand, director of the Little Jackalof Bay Otter Center near Homer, doesn't like the way the service plans to carry out the assessment.
They plan to take 650 animals out of the wild and capture them with tangle nets and use five different types of drugs to put them down and punch holes about a quarter inch in each flipper and put tags in them and take 30 milliliters of blood sample, blood drawn from each animal, and extract a premolar tooth from 650 animals, an additional implant transponder chips also in 650, and then the main large transmitters that are about the size of a cigarette pack, they want to implant another 275 and addition biopsy visceral fat from these animals.
Hillstrand says those otters fitted with transmitters can be continually recaptured and probed again for more fat samples, molars, and blood. But Mike Hedrick of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says besides the federal mandate for damage assessment, this is a study that needs to be undertaken.
It will document and quantify the damages that this particular oil spill had on an individual wildlife population, in this case sea otters. I think the greater benefit is the knowledge that will be gained that the public is going to have to use to decide what it wants to do with a wildlife species and oil. There are choices to be made, and the public has to make them in terms of how to balance the conflicting needs, a wildlife population on one hand, and the energy that this nation requires in the form of oil.
Hedrick also says the information will be gathered as evidence in a broad sense to be used in possible litigation against Exxon down the road. The proposed plan calls for the animals to be taken from the Prince William Sound area, since that's where most of the oil spill damage occurred to the otter population. Studies are also planned for other animals, such as river otters, bears, and seabirds. As soon as the sea otter study is authorized, work will begin immediately, meaning this fall, and will continue on through next summer. Nancy Hillstrand says there are other, less intrusive ways to study the effects of the oil spill on otters, like sampling the intertidal organisms that they eat. She says this study is adding insult to injury.
My question on this is, can you really state that this permit for scientific research does not on its own cause injury and damage to almost the same number of sea otters as were found dead on the beaches from the oil spill, and to release an animal back into the wild with four substantial bleeding wounds constitute injury under any guise of justification? So, I really kind of wonder why they want to injure something to find out what the injuries were.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service personnel say they are sensitive to the concerns of the otter advocates. Mike Hedrick says they're interested in hearing what people have to say, since the service is, in effect, working for the public as a federally funded agency. He called Nancy Hillstrand's viewpoint legitimate, but says it's only a part of the larger picture.
There's very little debate that an oil spill in areas that are inhabited by sea otters have a great deal of impacts on them. The debate then centers around how much impact, and that's what the service hopes to learn.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is soliciting comments on its proposed study through the end of September. Reporting from Homer, I'm Laura Wilkie.
Local Exxon officials got Port Lyon's hopes up earlier this week when they said the incinerator would be scrapped. But those hopes were dashed when Kodiak Island borough officials contacted Exxon in Valdez. Authorities there said they had made no decision to remove the burner. So Wednesday night, the borough went ahead with a scheduled public hearing on the incinerator issue. Residents testified overwhelmingly against allowing Exxon to fire up, not only in Vicoda, but anywhere on Kodiak Island. Then, Friday afternoon, the word came down from Valdez that Exxon truly is throwing in the towel. But according to Pete Skwartzoff of Port Lyons, residents there are hesitant to start celebrating just yet.
My reaction is, I guess we were told this before, and it turned out it wasn't true.
So you're not convinced yet?
I am not convinced. I really can't say, Charlene. I talked to PV earlier, and he told me he's on his way over to Port Lyons.
DEC originally granted Exxon's permit, but later suspended it for 10 days to give the Kodiak Island borough a chance to comment on the incinerator location. Exxon slams DEC in a written statement issued Friday afternoon, saying the company is scrapping the incinerator because DEC bungled the permit. According to Exxon's head of operations in Valdez, Otto Harrison, quote, "Permitting delays have frustrated the project as DEC refused to utilize its emergency authority and otherwise expedite the permitting process." Harrison goes on to say, quote, "The permitting delays will effectively use up the remaining time the unit could have been operated." But while Exxon has harsh words for DEC, the Kodiak Island borough has equally harsh words for Exxon. Community Development Director Linda Freed.
Exxon wants special treatment because they say this is a special circumstance. And in some cases, they can be accommodated. In others, the health and safety and the mental health and safety of people who have already been negatively impacted by the oil spill is more important than expediting their permits.
And like Pete Skwartzoff, Linda Freed says she's not convinced Kodiak can afford to let down its guard regarding the incinerator.
Exxon does not hold the permit for that incinerator. And until we get word from DEC that they have received word from the permittee, which is AET, that they don't intend to use the permit or that they're withdrawing their application, we will proceed as though the permit will continue to be processed and has the potential for being valid. Exxon, in this case, is the client of AET, but AET is the permit holder.
That's Community Development Director Linda Freed. In Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Cordova District Fishermen United sponsored the regatta of 20-some vessels which arrived from communities around the state. Spokesman Elise Scott questioned who would assume financial responsibility if a foreign tanker should spill oil.
These large crude carriers transport 50% more oil than the Exxon Valdez. These tankers' owners must have the financial capability to respond to a major oil spill from their vessels.
Alyeska fact sheets handed out at the time of the demonstration say less than 4 barrels of oil have been spilled by foreign tankers in the last 10 years, and foreign flagged vessels account for only 3% of all tanker traffic at the Alyeska terminal. Reporting from Valdez, I'm Sue Rapley.
Basically, the thing's about the height of a 12-story building. Some of the larger tanks are about the size of a 10 or 12-story building cubed. It's just overwhelming in its size. And equally overwhelming in its size are the areas at the bottom of the vessel that just aren't there.
It is not as easy for government agencies to go out and secure contracts for work vessels and the like as it is for a private corporation like Exxon. This is going to take us several days, but we're working on it, and we hope to have a plan we can release within, I'd say, a week. calls from people offering to work on a volunteer basis, and we have been notified by several of the vessel owners and vessel crews that they'd be willing to work on a volunteer basis to get to the bottom of this. These are genuine and generous offers. They're deeply appreciated.